Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur.
Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 310 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyree, your host once again. And today my guest is Lori Mihalich-Levin. Now, Lori is an attorney who likes to say practices law as a side gig. That's not really true, but she's a solo practitioner. And in addition to that, she's also the founder of something called Mindful Return. And it's really a really interesting business organization, course, book, blog, all about the issues regarding the return to the workplace of parents after paternal leave. Not necessarily after leaving the workforce to raise children and to come back again, but really that more transient dynamic that's associated with going on parental leave. And it's a fascinating discussion. I think she's hit on something that's really important in the workplace and is certain to grow by leaps and bounds going forward. So I'm very happy to be able to share with you my conversation with Lori Mihalich-Levin. Lori Mihalich-Levin, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Neil, happy Monday. It's so good to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, what a Monday it's been thus far. Hey, Lori, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Sure, Neil. So I live in Washington, D.C., and I wear three main hats in life. One is that I am a lawyer, appropriately for this podcast, perhaps. I'm a Medicare reimbursement nerd of sorts, and I focus on Medicare payments for graduate medical education, run my own practice called the GME Group, LLC. Second professional hat that I wear is that I run a program called Mindful Return that helps new parents transition back to work after parental leave and helps employers to retain their working parent talent. And then the third hat that I wear is mom to two wonderful redheaded boys who are ages 9 and 11 now, are in third and fifth grade, and for goodness sakes, have been finally back in person in school this year after 15 months at home. And gosh, it's amazing to have them where they need to be. Yes.
I don't know which is the more difficult task to deal with, the mom to two boys or the entrepreneur running a business. Lawyering might be the easiest thing.
Doing all three of them during the pandemic under one roof while trying to homeschool was the worst. So the hardest.
Yeah. I honestly don't know how people did it.
It wasn't pretty.
It was pretty messy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm lucky enough. Both my children are grown and past that stage. Mm. But I just don't know how folks did this. So, all right. So here you are. You got these three hats on, the most important of which is the mom hat. That goes without saying. Tell us a little bit about your career in the legal space. When you went to law school, did you go to law school here locally?
I did. Yeah, I came to DC specifically to go to law school and went to Georgetown. And I just basically never left DC since then. So it's been over 20 years.
Where were you from originally?
I'm originally from Pennsylvania, outside of Harrisburg. Okay. And DC was always the closest big city to me growing up. And I fell in love with it at a very young age and said, that's where I'm going, you know, when I get to be a grown up. And in fact, here I am. And you know, when I went to law school, I knew I wanted a regulatory career because I was a public policy major in undergrad and really loved policy and somehow learned that the rubber really meets the road in regulations. I also love foreign languages, and I consider regulations to be a type of foreign language.
Well, there is no question that It's a foreign language. Now, it's funny you should say that too, because you know, in my previous life, I worked for NASA. I worked in the space program, and I remember saying to somebody one day, "Yeah, I feel bad that I never really mastered a foreign language."
Mm.
And they said, "What are you talking about? You speak acronym."
Yes, yes.
And I had to think about it, and I thought, you know, that's entirely correct. I could have an entire conversation, and the layperson would have no idea what I was talking about.
Exactly.
And that's the true in regulatory settings.
True in regulatory settings. My children speak Pokemon. I do not speak Pokemon, so half the time I can't actually communicate with them. Right. Yeah, so I sort of dabbled in regulatory practices when I was a summer associate at a couple of law firms. And, you know, tried out telecom, regulatory, and energy, environmental, and then tried out healthcare and really liked the people I was working with and felt passionate about the causes and the clients that I was working for. So I did the big law firm thing for a couple of years, and then I wound up going in-house for 6 years at the Association of American Medical Colleges doing policy work. And then after 6 years there, and about a year and a half before I left there, I founded Mindful Return, and I wanted some daylight hours to work on what was then my passion project. And I wound up, perhaps ironically, going back to law firm life, and I went to Denton's and became a partner there for 6 years. So I practiced on a 60% schedule for about 5 years and a 50% schedule for a year while running my Mindful Return business in the other half of my week. And then last summer, I left Big Law and founded my own firm, which I now sort of say tongue in cheek is my side gig of practicing law. And I'm now sort of, you know, 2/3 Mindful Return and 1/3 the GME group.
So you were that rare law student who, when they said in the first week of 1L, what kind of law do you want to practice? You knew, or you had a good sense of what you wanted to practice, and you actually made that happen.
I had a sense of it, you know, but when I was in law school, it was basically, the question was, do you want to be a litigator or do you want to do, you know, corporate law? And my answer was no. Yeah. It was like, but I learned that there was this sort of hidden third regulatory track, right, that one could be on. And I struggled to find classes and folks who were interested in that third track. But then once I got out there and the real world of at least Washington, D.C., I found that to be a very blossoming type of practice that lots of people had. So I don't think law school focused on it very much.
No, isn't that ironic, though? Because I know I went here in D.C. as well. I went to Catholic law school. And the same question having been asked, what do you want to do? Really came down to, you want to litigate or do you want to be in business, do corporate law? Mm-hmm. You want to work with a big firm, or do you want to work in the state's attorney's office, and or do some other type of litigation work? And it's staggering when you think about it that arguably the center for the most regulatory work in the world,
yeah,
and activity, isn't truly represented by the law schools in that very city.
Yes, exactly. I managed to find one admin law class that I took my second year, but outside of that, I don't think anything I touched. I took a health law class too, but most of the health law was all around litigation issues. So, right. Yeah, it was a little tricky.
But as you said, out in the real world out there, there's, you know, that's the third leg of the stool, really, is regulations. And as most of us now know, there's far more law codified in the regulations than there is in the statute.
Exactly. It's where the impact really does seem to happen. And I felt like I could make a bigger difference by affecting what was going on in the regs.
All right. Well,
help
educate me, because I'm going to freely admit how little I really do know. When it comes to making policy, or, you know, not making policy, doing policy work, what does that mean?
What does that mean? Yeah. So I'll drill down just a little bit in my specific world, just to give you a real life example.
Yeah.
So most Americans know that the Medicare program pays for people who are 65 and older to receive health insurance, right? But most people don't know that Medicare also pays hospitals to train residents on the theory that this is a really expensive endeavor and we wouldn't have enough doctors otherwise. So there's about $14 billion a year that gets spent on graduate medical education for residency training.
Okay.
And when I was at the Association of American Medical Colleges doing quote unquote policy work, for example, I was doing sort of broadly speaking two things. One, every time the government puts out a proposed regulation, they have to tell the world what they're going to say in the proposed regulation. And then you typically have 90 days to tell them what you think of their plan. And so it was my role to represent the interests of about 300 teaching hospitals. And every time the government came out with an idea about how they wanted to regulate the payments to these teaching hospitals, it was, you know, on my shoulders to collect their respective opinions on what the government was saying, and then to feed back to the government, you know, write this thing called a comment letter, which isn't, you know, dear government, love Lori. It's like a really detailed analysis of what's in the regulation and what we think is good and what we think is bad about it. And could you please modify X? And then hopefully in the final regulation that gets published, those changes get implemented. So that's sort of part one of what doing policy advocacy was. And then the second piece was really educating the members on what the regs said and how they actually worked, so that the teaching hospitals didn't get themselves into trouble. You know, I was trying to keep people, and in my practice even now, try to keep people out of the orange jumpsuits, right? And make sure that they're following the rules and regulations appropriately, so that they don't get themselves into trouble.
I think there's a common perception amongst the public that when we talk about the work that's done, particularly here in this city and in Washington, D.C., but really in any, you know, state capital, as an example, there's so much work that goes into what ultimately ends up being 30 seconds on the evening news.
Right.
There's no way to comprehend the back and forth between policy wonks like yourself how critical that is to what goes on in this world.
It's critical, but you know, I fully recognize that talking about this stuff does not make for great cocktail party conversation. You don't want to really ask me what I do, right, at a dinner party.
Well,
the sausage making isn't so interesting to watch in practice.
Yeah, I guess it's all in how it's presented. But you know, I think about it that there's a lot of intelligence that has to be shared, you know, some done the right way, some done the wrong way, some we wish could be done differently. But at the end of the day, it's a lot of people getting together to help shape our collective approach to handling problems. And, you know, I think it's important work. I never ceases to amaze me when I talk to folks like yourself, just the level of understanding on the subject area, is just astounding. And we talk about, I mean, like consultants, the K Street corridor. K Street consultants here in Washington, D.C., terrible reputation.
Yeah.
People just think they are taking the money and running with it and is all a game. And look, there's some truth to that. For some people. I'm not naive enough to believe that's not true. But there's an awful lot of smart folks on K Street as consultants, really smart folks. And when I worked downtown, you know, getting in a conversation over an adult beverage with some of these people was just fascinating because they do know what they're talking about. So I'll get off my soapbox there.
And it all gets oversimplified in the evening news, to be sure.
It sure does. It's oversimplified or partisan, you know, driven.
Yes.
That is the way of the world at the moment.
Today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur is brought to you in part by my friend, Coach Mark Rockwell. Now, that name sounds familiar. You might remember hearing him as our guest on episode 277 of The Law Entrepreneur. And during that episode, we talked about a lot of different things. And one of is the fact that, did you know that only 12% of the law schools provide instruction on how to operate a law firm? 12%. That's one of the reasons managing a firm is difficult for most attorneys, particularly if they have no prior business education or experience. Wouldn't it be great if someone could guide you and save you the time and money figuring out how to grow and manage a profitable firm? Well, I highly recommend you visit with my friend, Coach Mark Rockwell. Mark helps individual attorneys, as well as law firm leadership teams, implement the structure and processes they need to grow and operate profitably. As a lawyer and a businessman, Mark knows firsthand what it's like to face the challenges of growing a profitable firm. Mark can help you do the same. Go to his website, coachrockwell.com, and download the Law Firm Checkup. That's Law Firm Checkup, which Mark will review with you at no cost. You'll get great insights on how to build a healthy, thriving law firm. You can call Mark directly at 503-784-7205 or visit his website at coachrockwell.com. That's coachrockwell.com. And my thanks to him personally for sponsoring today's episode. If you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent front-facing office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast. So you're making this transition, you go from big law and ultimately you scale down to doing your own thing, running it, as you said, as a side gig. What motivated you, or what kind of prompted you into going into this entrepreneurial activity about parents returning from parental leave?
Sheer desperation, Neil, prompted me into it. I am not an entrepreneur nature. Okay. I'm married to one. I'm married to someone who's a career coach and has his MBA. And, you know, we like to laugh that the thought that I would one day be an entrepreneur myself, you know, when we got married 13, 14 years ago, never, ever crossed his mind. I'm much more risk averse, et cetera. However, when I became a new parent and went back to work after parental leave, I was in a pretty dark place and I found that the world was just sort of spinning out of control for me. I went back to work full time after my first baby, and then I had another child 2 years later. And my husband and I joked that 1 + 1 felt like 85. Things were not pretty. Mm-hmm. And I looked around for resources and I said, you know, what could help me with this transition? What could help me feel better and to feel more successful and confident in going back to work? And all I could find was snarky advice related to my baby. you know, don't put a baby picture on your desk or people won't take you seriously. Go take this course about how to, you know, massage your baby or puree baby food for your baby, but nothing focused on me and the sort of professional and personal identity transition that I was going through. And so at the time, I wound up taking an online course called the Abundant Mama Project, which was really intended to help parents, not just new parents, but parents in general, find the abundance in life instead of just the overwhelm. And at the end of taking that class, I said to my husband, you know what, there really should be a class just like this, but for the transition back to work, you know, where there's a group of people who are all supporting each other through a transition and, you know, learning skills and how to do it in a better way. Of course, my husband sort of quipped back at me, well, what are you going to do about this problem? And I decided that, you know, despite having an 11-month-old and a 2-year-old, I was going to start blogging and, you know, creating this course. So I, you know, it was definitely the 20-minute a night passion project for a while, where I mapped out over the, you know, a couple month period, what I wanted to do each week and how I was going to build this course over a 4-month period. And ultimately I launched it and I launched the course in January of 2015. And, you know, it's been up and running ever since. We've had thousands of people go through it and it's become something I'm super proud of.
Well, you should be.
Now, what made you choose? Well, it seems to me, again, and I use this term lovingly, as a policy wonk, I'm a little surprised that your passion project manifested itself in a course. I don't think
rather than
a book, rather than,
well, it did as well. I did write a book.
Okay, well, tell us.
Yeah,
which came first, the chicken or the egg?
And the egg.
All right, and then I want to know. You said 20 minutes a night working on the course. Tell me how the course is delivered and how you work to make that a reality.
Yeah, sure. So I started off blogging and really just sort of getting my ideas out on paper/WordPress. And after about 2 years of blogging regularly, I looked through everything that I had written and said, oh, I think there's a book here already.
Sure.
Because I'd just been writing sort of consistently. So in 2017, I published a book called Back to Work After Baby, How to Plan and Navigate a Mindful Return from Maternity Leave, which you can find on Amazon. So it was sort of the blog came first and then the course and then the book, but they're all intertwined. And the course, you know, going back to policy wonk, perhaps because I'm a policy wonk, I love structure and order and being able to put things into buckets. And so the course is 4 weeks long and it has four themes. And these were the four themes that I wished I had focused on as a new parent, because I know it would have guided me toward a smoother return. And they're a mindful mindset for going back to work. That's the first week of the course. It's the sort of how to get your head in a better place piece. The second week is all about the logistics of returning, whether that's transitioning your baby to childcare or negotiating your schedule upon return or putting food on your own table at night, all those logistical aspects. The third week of the course is all about leadership in the space of return and viewing the skills that you're gaining as a working parent, as skills and the skills that you're gaining through parenthood, period, as translatable skills that are useful in your career and not, you know, parenthood just as a detriment to your career. And then the fourth week and fourth bucket is all about building and staying in community, mostly so you don't isolate yourself crying on the kitchen floor like I did for too long. Mm-hmm. So the course is delivered in this 4 week theme-based way, and it's an online cohort-based experience. So you're in it with other people who are all returning around the same time you are, and it's all asynchronous. You don't have to be anywhere at any given time of day or night because new parents have trouble being somewhere at a given time of day. And so every day, every weekday for 4 weeks, you get a lesson based on one of those four themes. And then there's a prompt and a discussion board, and everybody writes back and forth one another on this discussion board in a private course portal.
All right. So it's kind of like a guided trip through the information that you've developed over the course of writing the blog and the book and all the above.
Exactly. And, you know, about two thirds of the lessons were lessons that I wrote based on my own experience and my own research. And then the other third of the lessons, I brought in experts in areas where I just wasn't the expert to lead that lesson and teach the course. So like there's a clinical psychologist who focuses on anxiety issues in new parenthood, and she's the one who developed the lesson around that issue. So tried to, you know, reinforce my expertise with those of other people who have different skill sets.
All right. So let's go back to the four themes that the course navigates. So the first one we talked about was the mindset. What are some of the challenges that returning parents have? And particularly, let's kind of focus it down to returning lawyers who are parents. I mean, I'm sure the issues are the exact same for the returning baker or kitchen worker.
Yeah.
Okay. But we're talking about lawyers here.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think generally speaking, it's a lot of guilt, a scarcity mindset, a lack of confidence in what you bring to the table. I hear from, you know, new mom after new mom, well, if I was out for a couple of months, then maybe it means that my employer doesn't actually need me that much. You know, dealing with navigating changing the hats many times during the day and taking deep breaths in between the work hat and the home hat, and really like recognizing what stories we're telling ourselves during the day and building in time for micro micro moments of mindfulness, because new parents don't actually have a ton of excess time to be able to, especially to lawyers, right, to devote to it, right? But recognizing that even small intentional changes in our day can really make a difference in how we show up, both for ourselves and our clients and for our children.
So on a personal level, I will tell you, my mother ran the infant room in the daycare.
Oh my goodness. God bless her. Years,
right?
Yeah.
And, you know, if you didn't think she was a professional mother to start with, I mean, that experience cemented her opinion in her own mind that she was a professional mother.
Uh-huh.
But God love her. What she did was critically important. And she would tell you that the vast majority of her day involved helping parents, moms and dads,
mm-hmm,
cope with the whole concept of going back to work,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and leaving their child with somebody else.
Yeah.
And that there's a lot of energy misplaced on, you know, the worthiness of the individual to take that track. Because,
mm-hmm,
and a lot of projection. It's like, I don't have to do it, so why are you, you know, taking this approach? And, you know, most of the time she spent counseling these parents. So I can see how this is critically important.
Yeah, I love the term you just used, misplaced energy. I mean, if we spent our time focusing on other things rather than these spirals of guilt and shame that we can go down, imagine what we could do with that brain power instead. There's a book that Bridget Schulte wrote called Overwhelmed: Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time, which really, really made a huge impact on me when I was in that phase of, mm-hmm, like really needing to be counseled by the daycare teacher. And Bridget Schulte tells a story in there about an evolutionary anthropologist named Sarah Blaffer Hardy, who researched women in ancient civilizations and discovered that, you know, for thousands of years, women have been leaving their children, quote unquote, back at camp to be cared for by alloparents, as she calls them, people in their village. And that it's a totally normal thing to do, to have, mm-hmm, a village take care of your child. What's unusual is having just one person and having no support for that one person who's caring for the baby. And for me, that was revolutionary and helped me change that misplaced energy and say, oh, right. So it's normal to develop a whole group of people who are going to look out for my kid. And it's healthy for my kid to be able to, you know, get perspectives from other people. And for me, that is, you know, one thing that helped unhook me a little bit from that guilt.
So a lot of our solo practitioners are people who either are starting a solo firm, mm-hmm, because they want the flexibility as a parent, as a new parent, that maybe, mm-hmm, big law doesn't provide for them, or,
sure,
and they're dealing with the same kinds of issues. They may have the time off from the office might have been while transitioning from big law to their own solo practice, which again creates its own set of dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some of the skills that one would take away from taking the course here that would allow you to cope with that transition in a better way, in a more constructive way?
Yeah, well, I'm thinking about particularly wearing my entrepreneur hat, the biggest struggle in big law too is around boundaries, right? Between the time, because work can bleed into everything if you permit it. And so I think one of the things that the course is really helpful with is helping people normalize the idea that boundary setting is hard and can be challenging, and it's so much better, as Brené Brown says, than being resentful in your days, and learning how to develop good negotiation skills, mm-hmm, you know, in talking to people about setting deadlines, and learning how to recognize that you can't meet everyone's needs, period. Nobody can, yeah, right? And that you need to prioritize what needs are top and important for you, and really sort of like thinking into your values as you're deciding how to spend your day, I think can help you implement those boundaries a little bit better and help you feel like you have a little bit more sense of control and autonomy on a daily basis, instead of just the sense that like the world is one crazy, you know, boundaryless morass and you can't, right, get through a day. Yeah.
All right. Well, one of the other paths, mindset was the first one. The second one was
logistics.
Logistics. Yeah. And, you know, I think Now I'm going to make a huge leap here. I think that employers are more concerned with logistics of a returning employee than the interpersonal relationship with that employee or their mindset. You know, I see so many employers saying, like, well, how am I going to be able to get that 80 hours a week out of them? Or how are they going to be able to communicate? I can't have them running out of a meeting because they got to take a call from the daycare. It's all about the logistics.
Mm-hmm.
It gets in the way.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I work with tons of employers. Like, there are, I think, 85 employers that offer Mindful Return as a parental leave benefit. And what I wish is that employers would focus more on conversations around logistics and around making fewer assumptions around logistics.
Or dictating.
Dictating, okay. Right? But rather having open-ended conversations and recognizing that the person who left before they had a child is not the same person who is coming back afterwards. And, you know, having open conversations, I find that too many employers ignore the logistics of having a child and ignore the fact that, you know, there are morning and evening issues that have to be dealt with another human being. And you're right, though. I think there is too much emphasis put on how are we going to make it work at 6:05 p.m. rather than this is a human being doing a normal human thing of having a child and, you know, bringing forth the next generation of humans into the world. And how are we going to figure that out? I hope that the Great Resignation in this era of, you know, a war on talent is a time when people will think more about it and say, oh, I actually want to retain this person. And yeah,
I will tell you that I do see more of that, you know, having the opportunity to speak to a lot of law firm owners. I do see more, particularly this, you know, again, the solo and small firm owners, I do see them very purposefully addressing that issue.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been slow coming around.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And I will tell you also that I'm old enough, read that, I'm so old that I remember when parental leave was not for dads.
And we still have a long way to go on that, Neil.
We still do.
Yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, more and more places have gender neutral leave policies, but the uptake on them is still not equal.
No. And it's a whole different set of issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, I can't always say that the male side of this equation is always held themselves in the highest regard. When it comes to these things, there's an awful lot of nasty things said by men,
yes,
about fathers and their ability to cope and what they've given up and how different they've become. And it's not productive, guys.
Yeah.
It's not helpful.
And specifically for that reason, and because there are nuances to the experience, we separate people who identify as mom and have a course for them, and then have a separate course for people who identify as dad. And, you know, within that dad course, which I co-created with a finance guy from Bank of America who took two extended paternity leaves, we have lessons in there all about how to normalize those conversations around leave and how to assert yourself and take that leave even when other people might not be viewing it in the highest regard. So yeah. Still hear those stories, sadly.
Yeah, sadly, we do. All right. So tell me how the mom thing's going now.
Mom thing as in like me being the mom? Or
yeah.
9 and 11 are really awesome ages, I have to say.
Good.
We took a fantastic cross-country trip in our minivan last summer. I don't know if you know this, but there's a national program that allows all fourth graders to have free access to all the national parks. And so, like, federal government sponsored. And so last summer I had a fourth grader and we decided to, you know, take a trip in the minivan. And they're at that age where they're much more independent than they were. And yet they still want to hang out with us, which I know is about to end relatively soon. So I'm really sinking into and enjoying the time that, you know, we are having as a fun family of four.
My good friend, Jordan Ostroff, shout out to Jordan here if he's listening. Lawyer, marketeer, he's been a guest on the show before. Just got through taking a long, long road trip with his children, and I think did the same thing, was visiting a bunch of national parks for the same reason.
Yeah, it's a really fantastic opportunity. And yeah, we went 8,153 miles and we all still like each other. So.
That's fabulous. Well, Laurie, listen, this has been really kind of heartwarming. I enjoy taking note of the fact that there are people out there like you who are addressing the concerns of others that we have when we go back to work after bringing a child into the world. Because like you said, that in and of itself is an important function. And we shouldn't lose sight of that.
Amen.
And so tell our audience, what's the best way for them to reach out to you and maybe get a little more info about the course and your book? We'll have the book listing in the show notes, but tell them about the course and how they can connect with you and pursue this conversation even further.
Sure. Thanks so much, Neil. So if you head over to mindfulreturn.com, which is our website, you can learn about our courses for moms, courses for dads. We have Spanish language versions of them now. We also have a chapter in the UK, one in India, a couple of other international chapters coming out. We have a course for all working parents to help them with the balance called Mindful Return 201 that has another chapter coming up, another session coming up in May. I co-host a podcast called Parents at Work that you can find in all the places you normally find podcasts. And then you'll have the link to Back to Work After Baby. And I'm on all the usual social media channels. Go follow us over on Instagram at Mindful Return.
Well, it sounds great. And look forward to continuing to get to know you. You're right around the corner from me. So
yeah, we're neighbors, huh?
Yeah. I mean, normally I say, hey, next time I'm in LA, I'll stop in for a cup of coffee or a drink. Well, next time I'm around the Beltway.
Yes, next time you come down to Chevy Chase, D.C., I'll be right here. We can stop the politics and prose and grab a coffee.
Exactly. So let me say one more time, thank you for being a guest here today on The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you for having me, Neil. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Well, how about that? That's a wrap for this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I'd like to thank our sponsors once again, as usual, Daylight by Market Circle, Spotlight Branding, Ruby, as in Ruby Receptionists, and our newest sponsor, Security Plus. If you have a chance, swing on by our website at www.lawentrepreneur.com. You can check out a bunch of information and resources there. And if that doesn't satisfy your needs, swing on by our Facebook page or Twitter page. You can find those just by simply searching for The Law Entrepreneur. And if you'd be so kind, I would greatly appreciate it if you go to your podcast application and leave us a rating and an honest review. If you find this podcast is helpful and that you're getting value out of it, it does help with our visibility and ensures that we're going to be there for another 5 years or so, as this has been quite the run. And I'm greatly appreciative of your interest in The Law Entrepreneur.